Welcome to the Jack Duffley Show, a weekly podcast exploring investing, real estate, the markets, law, technology, and everything in between. Here's your host, Jack Duffley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Jack Duffley Show. I actually will not have a guest today, and instead we'll be using the time to talk about the very exciting topic that is house hacking. Before I get into that, just want to remind everyone that I'm on multiple platforms, including, as always, my website at jackduffley.com/show. Also available on YouTube if you want to see the video version of the podcast. And we're also available on iTunes, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes if you've liked the show thus far, or even if this is your first episode and you end up liking it. I'd very much be grateful if you left a review so more people can actually be exposed to this content. Now, as for today's topic, house hacking, it's a pretty simple concept. Basically, it's where you live in one unit or part of a unit in a building, and then you rent out the rest of it. It's really great for optimizing your budget and lowering your net expenses when it comes to your housing costs, but it can be a little intimidating to break into, and so I'll be going into how to do it in just a moment. But to kind of just illustrate this topic a little bit more, I personally house hack with my condo in Chicago. I bought my condo in Chicago using an owner-occupied loan, so it required a very low down payment. And I bought a place that was intentionally a little bit too big for myself. I bought a two-bed, two-bath condo, and obviously I would only need one bed and one bathroom for myself if I wanted to actually live in a place, and that's kind of the bare minimum. So I bought an extra bedroom and bathroom with the intention to rent it out after I closed on the place. And I actually have a video on my YouTube channel going over the exact numbers in greater detail, but basically, because I rent out my room, I'm able to cover basically the entire mortgage payment for my condo. So I just have to pay for, you know, utilities and that sort of thing. So it's not like I have a free house, but it's basically subsidizing your living costs by renting out your room and lowering your costs that way. Well, really, you're not lowering your costs. You're just expanding your income but still having almost the same expenses as you would otherwise. Yeah, you have some extra utilities because you have a roommate who's going to, you know, need water and power more than you would need on your own. But generally, the rent's going to be a lot more than what utilities would be. So it really helps a ton for getting your budget in a place where it's optimized for having the lowest net costs possible with basically the same living standards. I do have to sacrifice some privacy, as I'll get into, but really not much, considering the benefits. So how do you get into house hacking? It's a question a lot of people have, especially if they're unfamiliar with how the real estate game works, or maybe they've never actually owned a home before, or any piece of rental property for that matter. So the big way you're going to do it is by using debt. And thankfully, as an owner-occupied, if you're going to be living in the unit, you get really great options when it comes to debt. Owner-occupied financing is some of the best debt available in the entire world, partly because it's subsidized and sponsored by a lot of government agencies, so you get some help there and it lowers the interest rates a lot and allows you to get fixed-rate financing for 30 years, which is pretty phenomenal when you consider that your interest rate's going to stay the same, but meanwhile inflation will be eating away at that cost. So it's as though you're getting like you're really just getting a bargain rate compared to everything else. Inflation's going to keep going up over time, making the cost of your debt that much relatively lower over the long term. But anyways, without getting into too great of detail, the products you can get into with house hacking include some of the low down payment options. So you don't actually need to bring a ton of money to the table, at least relatively, to actually get into real estate. So some of the most popular options are the FHA loan or conventional mortgages. FHA loans only require you to put down 3.5% on the property. That means that if you had a $100,000 house that you wanted to buy with an FHA loan, you can get a down payment as low as $3,500. I mean, that's a month's salary for a lot of people, and even less for some others. And you can very quickly get into a pretty expensive property with very little down. Obviously, you're going to have to qualify for the debt, which I'll talk about in just a second, but you really don't need a big down payment when it comes to owner-occupied loans. With conventional financing, that is those loans sponsored by things like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the two big agencies that buy up a lot of mortgages in the U.S., they typically require about 5% down. That's the kind of loan I use for my condo. I ended up putting 12% down, but typically if you weren't using an owner-occupied loan, you'd have to put 20 to 25% down on a property. So with that same $100,000 house, if I wasn't using an owner-occupied loan to buy my condo, I would have needed to put down about $20,000 to $25,000. I mean, that's a lot of money no matter which way you spin it. And I didn't have that much in savings at that point, at least I don't think. And if I did, it would have been everything I had. And you don't really want to put in all of your money into one property because you want to have some reserves left over in case something bad happens, you lose your job and you can't make your mortgage payment. Or if you had a roommate that you were relying on their income, you lose the roommate, you still have to pay for the debt. So anyways, I would have needed to bring a lot more if I wasn't using an owner-occupied loan. But because I was, I could have gone as low as 5% down. I decided to do 12 because I was trying to get rid of what's called private mortgage insurance quicker. But that's beside the point. The point is you don't need a lot of money to house hack. You just need to make sure that you can qualify for these loans. And that's probably the hardest part about house hacking, at least to getting started, is you don't really need to bring a lot down. You typically, if you're looking at a $100,000 or $200,000 place, you're going to need $5,000 to $20,000 in a down payment. And also to cover closing costs, you'll need a few thousand on top of that. But I mean, all things considered, you can get into a pretty large property. Because the best thing, perhaps the best thing at least, besides the low down payment, when it comes to these FHA and conventional loans, besides having a fixed rate, interest rate, and being long-term debt and not having to bring down, not having to have a huge down payment to actually start, is that you can buy a 1-to-4-unit building. It doesn't have to just be a single-family home or a condo. It can be a 4-unit building. So you can really expand your income pretty instantly by using a very low down payment. So even if you had a million dollar home, that happens to be a 40-unit, you could get into that building, a million-dollar place, with $50,000. I mean, that is a lot of money either way, but if you weren't using a conventional mortgage that required you to put 20% down, then you're looking at a $200,000 down payment. But because you're using a conventional loan and only had to put 5% down, you only have to bring $50,000 to the table as opposed to $200,000. That's a massive difference and can let you get into large properties very quickly, comparatively. You don't have to save up this massive down payment and can get into a property with very little money, comparatively. So to get these loans, though, you do have to have a really good credit profile. That comes with your income and your credit score. We'll start with your credit score. Your credit score is kind of your measure that determines, or at least that shows lenders, indicates to them how credit worthy you are. And that is how you've handled your debts in the past. If you've handled them poorly, you're probably going to have a low score. Or if you've never had credit in the past, which could be the case, if you didn't have any student loans, don't have a credit card yet because you're anti-debt at the moment, then you might not have a credit score yet. And you just have basically a zero credit score, and lenders won't really know what to make of you, which is good and bad, I suppose. But to get your credit score up, there's a few factors that go into it. The biggest one being your payment history. So if you've been making your payments on time, have never missed a payment, never been late on a payment, then you're probably going to be having a pretty good credit score. But if you've missed a payment in the past and you haven't been able to clear it up with credit agencies because you did, in fact, miss the payment. It's undisputed. You just forgot 1 year and you, let's say you opened up a credit card at a store and then you forgot that you opened that credit card at the store and you never made the payment on that card and you've carried that balance for a year now and it's tanked your score. And not to mention you have a nice hefty balance for a store card that you thought you were using to get your little 20% discount at whatever retailer you were at. But now it's biting you in the butt because your credit score is trashed. That's because your payment history looks really bad. You haven't made payments on a card or whatever debt product it happens to be. It could apply to student loans, car loans, or whatever you've had in the past. You have to be very careful whenever you take any sort of debt out. Your payment history is the number one factor when it comes to making up your credit score. If you don't make your payment history really tidy, if you're not making your payments on time, if you're letting things go into delinquency, if you're being threatened with being sued by credit companies because they're trying to collect on you, like, that's no good. That's going to really hurt your credit score, and rightfully so. You look like a terrible borrower to someone who's trying to lend you money because you haven't paid your other lenders in the past, and they don't want to see that. But another factor that's pretty big with increasing your credit score is your credit utilization, and that's how much credit you have. and that is how much credit you're using of the credit that you have. So if you have a $1,000 credit card, that is a $1,000 limit on your credit card, and you're using $900 of that credit card every month, you have a 90% utilization rate. And that doesn't look very good to lenders either, because it looks like you're maxing out your credit and you're trying to use as much debt as possible. And that makes you more risky, because if you suddenly don't pay, you have a lot of debts to pay off. And that lender's not going to be a priority because there's a ton of other debt that you're using. So they don't like that either. It's not as big of a factor as your payment history, but it's important nonetheless. So another reason to pay down your cards as quickly as possible if you have credit cards, or pay off other lines of credit that are being utilized to a significant degree. Ideally, you don't want to have any utilization, but try to at least get it under 20%. That's kind of a benchmark rule. As long as your utilization rate's under 20%, it shouldn't really affect your score that negatively. But ideally, if you have any credit card debt, you should be paying that off right away anyways, because good luck trying to find something that gets you an 18% return on your money, which is greater than the interest rate on your credit card. Pay off your credit cards, everyone. Without going into too many of the other factors with your credit score, the other big ones are how recently you've applied for new credit. So that is, if you've had hard pulls on your credit report recently, that'll ding your score for about 2 years after you've done that. And then also your credit mix is another factor, which is what types of credit do you have? Do you have just credit cards and lines of credit? Do you have student loans? Do you have auto loans and other types of installment loans? That's another thing that's important. And then the last thing, if I can remember it, oh, of course, it's your length of credit history. That is how long you've had credit. So the longer you've had credit open, the better. The average age of your credit card, the higher it is, the more experienced of a borrower you are, and the more attractive you are to a potential lender, because it shows that you've handled credit for a long time and you haven't had many issues with it, hopefully none, and that will make you a much more attractive borrower to them. So those are kind of the things that make up your credit score. Now, the other thing that's important for getting approved for debt is your debt-to-income ratio. This is incredibly important when it comes to mortgages. It's really the biggest barrier that a lot of people have to overcome. And when a lender, if you've ever shopped for a home before and want to get pre-approved for a mortgage, what they're really doing is they're looking at your debt-to-income ratio and approximating how much mortgage you could possibly take on before they hit the threshold that cuts you off from being able to get approved for a mortgage. And that threshold usually is 45% of your monthly income. So that means that when you go to get a mortgage, a conventional mortgage at least, with FHA, it might be able to get higher to about 55% depending on the program, but we'll just say 45% is the benchmark since that's what most people have to face. What that means is that you cannot use more than 45% of your income towards your debt payments or your monthly obligations, and that includes rent in some cases. So you have to be careful with that. So even if you have $100,000, we'll say you make $100,000 per month, like you have a hefty salary. If your debt payments are $50,000 per month, you're at a 50% debt to income ratio. So you're not going to get approved for a mortgage in most cases because you already have too high of a debt to income ratio. Even though you're making all this money, they don't really care because that's just part of their formula. And even though you're making all this money, you're also paying a lot in debt, and they don't want to go over these debt-to-income ratio limits because then you become what they call over-leveraged, and you're at risk of defaulting because the more debt you have, technically the more risk you're taking on because the more people you have to pay. And if you lose your source of income, well, there's a lot of people that still need to get paid, and they don't care that you lost your source of income. So you got to keep that in mind when you're going to shop for a mortgage. You got to keep your debt-to-income ratio under 45%. Now, I have a lot of the same information on my website at jackduffley.com. I have some things about debt-to-income and using debt in real estate. And if you want to read more about it and kind of see how it all works together, definitely check that out. I have a lot of content on my site for that. So in general, though, if you have outstanding debts and you want to make room for a mortgage, do that. Make room. Pay off high interest debts for sure. Maybe consider paying off things like car loans and other types of debt to make room for a mortgage, because your mortgage is typically going to be a pretty hefty payment each month. And perhaps the biggest barrier for a lot of at least young folks right now is student debt. And how to get rid of student debt is a big barrier to trying to actually get into a mortgage, because student debt is really burdening a lot of people. Some people have six-figure student debt without a house to show for it, and if you're not making a ton of money to pay that debt off quickly, it can be a huge burden because you're limiting your opportunities in other areas, like getting a mortgage so you can house hack or do other things like that. So that should be a top priority. If you have a high debt to income ratio, It's time to make that ratio lower by paying off some of your existing debts, or at least paying them down so that your monthly payment gets lower and that you open up space so that you can take on a nice low interest rate mortgage to start house hacking. Now, the next obstacle you might come up with is finding your down payment. Even though it might only be 5% down, if you've never saved more than a couple grand in your life before, saving up $10,000 or even $20,000 if it's a big property, that's going to be difficult. And if you're not used to having a rigid budget and saving automatically from your income, that can be a tough thing to do. So that's another priority you're going to have to have going into house hacking. And frankly, you really should be saving, or at least be able to save, a significant portion of your income before you buy any piece of real estate. Because if you can't have reserves at the ready, or at least be able to pull reserves from your income, you're going to have a problem if anything happens to your property, the property needs repairs, something bad happens to the property that insurance doesn't cover for some reason. You're going to need to have cash at the ready. And if you can't save, you're going to be in trouble because you're going to have to take out some high interest debt to pay it off. And then you're paying this premium on the interest, and no one wants that. So being able to save is a big deal. And perhaps the best way to save really for anything is to automate it, as I kind of mentioned earlier. And the way you can do that is a lot, if you have a job that offers direct deposit, which I think just about everyone does now, maybe if you're a 1099 contractor, you're probably going to get paid via check sometimes. The more you can automate your savings, when you use direct deposit, for example, you can have your paycheck go to two savings accounts. One saving account, you'll have 5% of your check automatically go towards your investment or your house savings account. I want a house hack, so I'm going to have a house hack savings account where 5% of my income, no matter what, goes directly to that. Then the other 95% goes to your normal checking account, whatever you want to do with it. But being able to automate it that way, taking the emotion out of saving, is a great way to build up any savings for any goal, including house hacking. You automate your saving by having your money go out of sight, out of mind, to the place that you want it to go before the money's actually in your hand. Because when it's in your hand, it's very tempting to spend it on something, to use it to do something else that you've always wanted to do. Just wait. If you have a goal that you're saving for, keep saving for it. Make it automatic. Take the emotion out of it. It makes it so much easier. Because no matter how disciplined and smart you may think you are, it's so tempting to take the money that you have in your account and spend it on things. When the money's there, it's used. That's just a fact of life. So get the money out of there. Have it automatically go to some place where it's safe and that you can use it later. And it has to be very intentionally used, not accidentally used just because it happens to be in your checking account, which you have a nice debit or credit card hooked up to where you can spend money right out of it. No one needs that. So try to have it go to some separate savings account. You got high yield savings accounts through banks like Ally Bank that are great for this sort of thing. So you can put your money there and it'll at least make a little bit of interest, unlike a lot of the bigger banks, which do not pay you anything in interest. So that's just an idea. Another thing you can work on is budgeting and lowering your expenses each month, which is semi-ironically what house hacking aims to do. It aims to limit your net expenses. Well, before you get into house hacking, if you're trying to save up your down payment, take a firm look at your budget. Thankfully, I have a free budgeting tool on my website. I'll leave a link in the description where you can actually build a budget and kind of see what amount you can save each month and get a better grasp on your current financial picture. Because if you don't have a grasp on that, you're never going to be able to save anything. Because it's going to be very easy to spend a ton one month, maybe go beyond your means. But if you don't have a clear picture of what your financial, where your money is going when it comes in, if you don't know where your money's going out, you have no way of really controlling it. So getting a clear picture on your budget, even if you don't follow it super rigidly, at least having a general idea of where the money's going will help with that. Because you can make big cuts or significant cuts in things that you don't need to buy, or things that you don't need to keep spending money on. And then that money can be diverted towards your savings account that's being used to build up your down payment. Now, once you have your down payment saved up, or as you're saving it up perhaps, you can start looking for properties. As I mentioned before, house hacking with owner-occupied loans lets you get into 1 to 4 unit buildings. That's one thing you should decide as well. Do you want to do, you know, a little simple thing like I did, buying a condo with an extra bedroom and bathroom and just renting out the room? It's probably a lot more manageable than if you don't have any experience in real estate, or maybe you're not that interested in real estate, and you don't want to buy a 4-unit building and become essentially a landlord of 3 other units, that can be a lot to take on. If you're up for the challenge, I mean, by all means, do it. It's a very powerful strategy for building wealth and definitely lowering your expenses. Consider what it is you actually want out of this. Do you just want to have a place that's cheap to live in, or do you really want to try to start maximizing your wealth and building income streams? Then decide how many units you're going for. Maybe you want something in between. You buy a duplex, rent out one side, live in the other. That's a great idea too. Or you can even kind of parse it out even further. You buy a 2-unit building, but one unit, that unit that you're in also has extra bedrooms. So not only do you rent out the unit next door, but you also rent out one of your rooms, and you can really maximize your income that way and lower your net expenses the most that they possibly could be lowered while still owning real estate. Now, when you decide your strategy, the hardest part, at least the most intimidating part, is figuring out what a good house hack property looks like, since the most expensive property in the block might not be a very good property to actually use for house hacking. It might not bring enough rental income in to cover your expenses, and then you're going to be in over your head. So kind of being able to run the numbers on a property will really help you a lot to make sure that you're getting a good deal on a house hack type property. I have a free rental metrics spreadsheet where you can kind of learn how to run the numbers on a property. There might be a bit of a learning curve in figuring out how this works, but at least knowing that if you end up moving out of the property, it's a break-even rental, that's powerful, because you know you have more financial flexibility when, if you decide you don't want to live in this house forever, and you don't, or maybe you don't want a house hack forever and you decide to move out, you can be more confident in keeping that property anyways and then renting it out as a rental, and you could keep the wealth building potential that comes with owning a property over the long term. And you don't have to sell it and then use that money to then buy another house that you're never really building a lot of equity in, or you're not really getting any cash flow benefits from either. So consider that when you're buying really any piece of real estate, whether it be your house, or if you're house hacking, or if you're buying a rental, run the numbers. See how it would do as a rental. If you buy a house that could serve as a good rental, you always have that security. Whether you want a house hack or not, you have that security that if you want to move out of this house, you don't have to sell it, because you could just rent it. And when you rent it, the rental income will at least offset all the expenses and pay the mortgage, and you're still getting that principal pay down each month with the mortgage. So just consider that when you go in to buy any piece of real estate, including your house. It can really help you with your flexibility and really your peace of mind, so that if things get bad and you need to move, or maybe there's an opportunity somewhere else that you want to get to, you don't feel like you have to sell your whole house and then go through that whole lengthy process. You can just pick up, move, rent it out, done. And if it's a good rental property from the get-go, it'll probably be a pretty good rental property a couple years later, as long as you take good care of it and your market doesn't go completely sideways, or completely downwards, I should say. Sideways would be not a bad thing if it started out good. So consider that before you get into it. Practice running the numbers on properties. If you know you want a house hack even many months from now, take a look at properties on Zillow or Redfin, and take a look at apartments.com in those same areas. See what things are renting for. You can kind of get a good feel for what your kind of rent to price is. What would a property in that neighborhood rent for compared to what can you get a property for by buying it? Compare those numbers and figure out what your rental market would look like if you ended up house hacking. It'll really help you to get a good grasp and be able to identify what a good deal is when one comes on the market, when you're actually ready and you have your down payment set up and you have your credit ready to go. But before you actually get into the property, you're going to need to put together a team as well. And putting together a real estate buying team can be also a little intimidating, especially if you've never done it before. But generally, you can kind of look at it like this. There's 5 main team members that you're probably going to have to find out. One is your broker. You need a real estate agent, or you don't necessarily need one, but it really helps to have one on the buyer's side. It doesn't cost you anything, and you can have that agent help you search for properties that meet your criteria. You let them know, like, hey, I'm looking for a duplex. I don't care about single family homes. I'm trying to house hack. I want to live in one unit, rent out the other. Can you send me duplexes in this neighborhood? Your broker will do that for you, and that's really nice, because you basically have a sort of employee. They are called your agent, after all. They are your agent working on your behalf to try and get you the best result that you want. So that's the first step. You get a broker on your side. Second step is to find a lender or multiple lenders. And this is where your broker can come in as an ally to help you find lenders as well, because more experienced brokers will typically have a lot of connections in the area and will be able to connect you with lenders that they've used in the past or that is that clients have used in the past that they've had. And you can immediately get connections with local lenders. You can also obviously use Google to find lenders. There's a ton of lenders out there, which can be intimidating. Because you might want to use one of the big banks, but there's a lot of local lenders who might have good products as well, or at least low interest rates. And it's best to consider multiple options when it comes to financing. So find a lender and ask and tell them, I want to do house hacking. I want to consider what my option would be between an FHA loan and a conventional loan. Or if you're a veteran, maybe a VA loan, put 0% down, do the same strategy. So ask them your options, try to get some pricing, some quotes on the loan, and then you'll be in a better position because you'll know what your options are on the lending front as well, and make sure that you're getting the best deal by comparing options between lenders. The next person you'll need on your team, even if you're in a state that doesn't require an attorney, is an attorney. That is, your attorney is your legal ally, whereas your broker's kind of your sort of point man on your team who helps get the deal rolling. Your attorney's the one who kind of carries the freight through the middle, at least in conjunction with the title company, which searches for the title history on a property to make sure it's clean and that there's no bad things with the property. There's no tax liens or, you know, all that bad stuff. They want to make sure the property's good to go and that you're not getting into something that you didn't know you were getting into. So your attorney will also be able to help you determine your attorney will help you to go over the legal risks that come with buying properties as well if you have any questions about that, or at least they can get you in touch with someone who can help you with that, since most real estate attorneys are really specialized in real estate, or at least that's who you should be using. Don't use a general practice attorney when it comes to buying a property. Use someone who specializes in real estate transactions because they'll know what they'll be doing, whereas a general practice person who's not used to real estate transactions might not know what they're doing, and even if they end up doing it, they might be slower or more expensive, and that's no good. So try to find an attorney who specializes in real estate, and they'll be kind of your ally through that process. The next person you'll need after you get under contract and look at after you get under contract, and everything's solidified, is a property inspector. A property inspector will help you to look through the property, obviously it's in their name, and make sure that there's nothing catastrophically wrong with it that you didn't notice before. And really walking through a building with an inspector, it's amazing the things that you'll miss as someone who might have not a lot of experience or even has a lot of experience walking through properties. You'll be surprised what an inspector can find, and that can really turn the deal either way, because you might not realize, oh, there's a huge mold problem in this part of the house that I wasn't anticipating. That's going to be expensive to fix, or that sort of thing. Or maybe there's a leak somewhere that you didn't notice, and that's going to need to be fixed. Your inspector is one of your most powerful lines of defense, because they provide you with information. Information is defense in real estate. The more information you have going in, the more secure you are, since you know what's going on. And that goes really for any sort of investment ever. The more information, the better, because you have a better idea of what's going on. So your inspector helps to collect that information for you and put you in a better position before you get to the closing table. Now, if you do end up closing, you're also going to need an insurance agent heading into closing. An insurance agent will help you to find a homeowner's policy to make sure that you are insured. If you have a lender on this deal, if you're not buying all cash, which I assume you will be using a lender, you're definitely going to need homeowner's insurance, because a lender's not going to let you go uninsured. Because if the property gets hit by a tornado and rips off the roof and you can't afford it, the lender wants to make sure that their collateral, your house, is still in good shape. So they're going to make sure that your homeowner's insurance policy can cover that. And you're going to want that anyways, too. You never know what's going to happen if there's some big damage from a storm, or if someone trips and falls and hurts themselves on your property, you're probably on the hook. So just make sure that you're well insured and that you're not going to be blindsided by some problem and have to come out of pocket for it and not have the cash, because that'll just lead to all sorts of problems. So those are kind of your five people: the broker, lender, attorney, inspector, and insurance agent. You might have some others. If you're trying to do a rehab, you'll have contractors and that sort of thing. That's kind of beyond the scope of this. We'll just assume it's a decently clean property, or maybe you're going to do the work yourself. Now, the next sort of phase is closing and then renting it out. Renting it out, you can try to rent it yourself. That's what I did with my condo. I actually just posted listings on Craigslist, took nice pictures of the property, made sure it was well lit and clean, obviously, and got quite a few rental inquiries, because as long as you price your rental correctly, you should have some flexibility in picking a quality tenant with, you know, good income history, and making sure that they can pay rent and that sort of thing. And more importantly, if you have a roommate, make sure it's someone that you can cooperate with and wouldn't cause problems in that sort of way. And if you're using an agent, they can do that for you as well. If you decide that you want to pay an agent to go find you a tenant, that can take a lot of the work out of it, but you're still going to have to make the final call on whether you want that tenant there, obviously in compliance with fair housing laws if you're using a real estate broker. But when it comes to renting, just be prepared that you are becoming a mini landlord in a way. Even though you're living on the property, you are bringing on a tenant, and that does come with some serious responsibility. If you sign a lease, you're signing a contract that binds both parties. You have to honor the lease too, just as your tenant does. So you got to make sure that you're following the rules that you've set in your lease, and obviously following the law as well. Just be careful with that. If you're obviously unsure, law is different in every city and state. So contact a local attorney if you're really unsure about something. But in general, that's kind of the rule of thumb. If you make the rules, you better follow them. Now that kind of brings up a big objection to house hacking. What if you don't want to be a landlord? What if you don't want to sacrifice privacy as well? Well, that's kind of the cost of doing something like this. You do become a sort of landlord. At least in the roommate situation, it'll probably be kind of more like an extension if you were just at college and had multiple roommates. It's really just kind of that, only in this case, you've replaced your landlord. You're not paying a third-party landlord. You are the landlord. But the living situation should be about the same, I would assume at least. Maybe with less alcohol. We'll see. So that's just a cost of doing house hacking. You do become a sort of landlord. Now, if you're using a 2, 3, or 4-unit property, you can actually hire a property manager to take care of the other 3 units if you really don't want to have a lot of extra, you know, no late night phone calls and that sort of thing. You can just turn it over to a property manager, and it would probably work decently well if it's all separate units. Now you're going to lose some of your rental income, but you would have a lot of your time back if you end up having a problem tenant. But that's up to you to decide whether you want to use a property manager, but it is an option, especially in a larger building with multiple separate units. It's easier to kind of separate the responsibilities there too. But you still are ultimately the person who makes the final call on managing the property. So you are still a landlord, but really where a lot of the stress comes in real estate is as a property manager. So you can turn over a lot of those responsibilities to someone else depending on how it works. And definitely once you move out of the property and don't really want anything to do with it anymore other than the wealth benefits, then you could turn it over to a property manager, pay the property management fee. And that's actually another consideration to make when you're running the numbers on a property. Make sure that if you don't want to manage it yourself, make sure that you're factoring in property management fees to make sure that the property would work well as a rental with professional management. Now, as to the privacy point, you do lose some privacy. Even in a 4-unit building, if they're attached units, you're going to be sharing things like the vestibule, the lawn. You're going to hear creaking above you if you have hardwood floors, like many buildings do here in Chicago. So you do lose some privacy there. If you're already used to city living or more dense living, that probably isn't a problem. Or if you get a building that has separated units that maybe share just a lawn but are otherwise separate, they're not stacked on top of each other, that can work too. There are a number of those sorts of properties around as well that don't share ceilings and walls. So it's not necessarily the case that you're going to lose a lot of privacy. If you have a roommate, obviously you won't be that as private as you would be if you had your own unit, because you're sharing, now you're sharing probably a kitchen, maybe you're sharing a bathroom if you don't get an extra bathroom, and you have to be prepared for that. However, again, like I mentioned, if you're coming out of college and you just were doing that anyways, what's a couple more years like that really going to do to you if it really means you're going to get this sort of financial benefit in lowering your living costs drastically? So you can use that money to pay down things like your remaining student loan debt if you have any, or to start investing for your future if you want to get that ball rolling while you're still young. But house hacking is not just for young people. It's for anyone looking to get started in real estate or even continue in real estate. It's a great tool for lowering your expenses, your net expenses, by increasing your income. Your expenses are really the same either way. You're either going to rent a place or you're going to buy a place and pay a mortgage, which with interest rates so low, typically ends up being close to the same as rent. You just have to fork over the down payment. So why not have someone else subsidize that mortgage payment and lower your cost of living dramatically? by having increased income against the same expenses, or at least close to the same expenses. It's definitely worth looking into if you're looking for a way to really ramp up your financial progress towards whatever goals you might be going for in and out of real estate. The final note, in short, how do you get started? Well, the first step is to get educated. Learn about real estate, learn how it works. You don't have to become an expert, but at least have a good grasp on the market that you're going for. Start asking people about maybe people who've done it. I've done it. Definitely feel free to reach out, jack@jackduffley.com. It's my email. You can also reach out to me on YouTube in the comments section. I always answer those. But ask people who've done house hacking. Ask about their experience. Ask how they got started. Ask for tips and tricks and that sort of thing. Ask brokers or real estate agents in your area. How do I get started with this sort of thing? Ask lenders. You know, start collecting information. Because the more information you have, the more secure you are and the more well-equipped you'll be when it comes time to actually get the ball rolling. And the other major factor to get started is to start budgeting. Take care of your credit. Make sure your credit score is in a good place, your debt to income is in a good place, so that you're ready to take on a mortgage and that you can use your debt productively towards something that will lower your expenses rather than raise them. Well, it's just about time to wrap up. So thank you for listening to me rant about house hacking for this whole time. I definitely hope you found it informative. And if you did, please leave a like if you're on YouTube, or a friendly review on iTunes or something like that. The more people like this episode, the more people will be exposed to this important information. Otherwise, have a great rest of your week, everybody, and take care.
Thanks for listening to The Jack Duffley Show. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss any new episodes. For more content on personal finance, real estate, and other topics, check out jackduffley.com.